have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here. Welcome to another guest episode of the Business Broker Grow Show. Today I have with me Mr. Josh Carnes. He is the owner of Lion Business Advisors. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to join you today.
This is fun for a couple of reasons. One is you are in Texas, and so it's fun because you and I were just chatting. You know Jared Johnson. You checked out his episode. You've done some content together. So it's kind of fun having another Texas person here and kind of expanding the people who know each other. The other thing that's interesting, and we'll talk a lot about it today, is that you also have a podcast. And so you're familiar with this. You know, it should be fun for you on that side of the mic this time.
Hopefully I'm familiar enough with it.
It should be good. So let's talk about kind of your pathway to get to where you are now. What I always love to hear, because I think it's fascinating every time, is how someone becomes a business broker or becomes aware of business brokerage and that pathway for you.
Yeah, I think I'd say most older people in the industry, I got the gray hairs coming in. I can say that now. I stumbled into this industry. So the short version was I was at a marketing firm where I was employee number one. They exited. I was lightly familiar with the process, had some time to myself. I comically put together a full business plan and was going to go into residential real estate. Set with a couple mentors of mine, and they're like, hey, so you would suck at that. You deal with business owners, not soccer moms, kind of a different personality. And they actually introduced me to the person who facilitated the transaction for our firm that we exited. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. It's like real estate for business, and I get to deal with business professionals. And that was 10 years ago. This year. And so that's how I stumbled in.
And is that, was that an accurate assessment? Was the guidance accurate that you got over 10 years ago that this is better than soccer moms and real estate?
Somewhat. we still get to deal with every personality. For me personally, call it ADD or what you will, I have to have a continuing challenge. And so one of the things I love about this industry, it doesn't matter how many HVAC deals you do, every single one is different and unique. And yeah, so for me personally, my mentors at the time were spot on. this is what I need to do. We've now decided this is my thing. I'm obviously all in, and I found my home for business. So
It's fascinating to think about that too, is depending on the personality type, right? Some people, residential real estate is great. They either build a team, they build a process, they like the routine, they like that scale, they like helping people on an individual, consumer basis versus, say business owners. It's a different game that, funny enough, still falls under residential real estate, depending on what state you're in and licensing, right?
Yeah, some states, not Texas yet, but—
Not Texas.
Yet.
So in your 10 years of doing it, I'm always curious at what you've seen as far as changes in business owners. Like, are you seeing more awareness? Are people understanding that this exists and is even a thing? Is it still a challenge for awareness and education?
So I think it's still a challenge for awareness and education, but it's nowhere where it used to be, right? So when I first came into the industry, I would tell people I'd spend the first 30 minutes of a 1-hour meeting with a seller client, educating them on what a business broker is, why they should use one, what we do, what it means, why it's important that I'm a member of TAB and IBBA and all these other things. And now we're actually getting calls that are saying, hey, I'm interviewing 3 brokers, come pitch me. And so for me personally, it is much more fun to try and explain why Lion is different and how we help clients versus spending time on what is a business broker. So definitely have seen that evolution in the last 10 years. And for me, it's a better thing. There's more brokers in the industry than there were 10 years ago. We're starting to see younger brokers in the industry, which is also great. I remember my first day walking into a tab lunch, no offense to all my tab guys. I was easily 20 plus years the youngest guy in the room. And now some of those guys are still there, thankfully, and I am by no means the youngest guy in the room, right? So seeing more brokers coming in, seeing more awareness in the industry, I think it's a growing industry, and I think it's for the better.
Now, one of the things you told me before when we spoke is that there's, I think you said, like tens of thousands of real estate agents in a market like Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
And maybe 150 business brokers in that area, in the States. Like, you know, how is that scale even there? Like, what's, is there competition? You know, you people who are interviewing three brokers, but I'm also guessing there's probably not enough business brokers to help everybody if they wanted to sell anyway.
There's not. And so it is a still an interesting time in the market. And I would say that our industry is still small enough where most of us know each other and help each other. So comically, when a seller owner is interviewing three brokers, I probably know one of the other two at a minimum. And so that does make it interesting. The numbers for real estate agents are crazy. And the, kind of going back to the equation, which I know people hate, of we do real estate for business. There's just nowhere near as many business brokers as there are. In the state of Texas, we're only at like less than 500 registered business brokers. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of business brokers out there that are unregistered. And I think that's happening in every state, which is a whole nother conversation that we could probably dive into. But even on the national level, right, the IBBA, which is our realtor designation, they're just now, I believe we just hit over 5,000 members nationally. And IBBA within the last year or so. And so the industry is definitely growing, but there's room, right? It is one of those weird things to where we are not a saturated market, and the more than welcome.
Yeah. And so you said registered. What does that look like in Texas? Because I'm not familiar with that. So you mean there's 500 registered business brokers. How are they registering, or what are they registering through?
Through the Texas Association of Business Brokers, okay. Right? We are essentially a affiliate of the IBBA, which is the International Business Broker Association. So it's more of a registration than anything. Now, you can become a board certified business broker in the state of Texas. I would recommend that everyone does that. But it is this weird thing to where we're not California and Florida. We're not governed by the Department of Real Estate. In my opinion, probably a good thing. But it does have its negatives to where there is no mandated education. Education is up to the business broker to go out and get.
Yeah, it's interesting to have that registration through TAB. You mentioned California and Florida. It's interesting, you know, the states that require it under real estate. If you were in charge, or how should I say this? You can answer it however you want. What would you do with business brokerage? Because you have your podcast, you talk to a lot of people, you talk to, we'll get to it, like the founding member of TAB and or maybe business brokerage. I don't know.
Yeah.
We could talk about that story. But what would you do to put this in a profession bucket?
Yeah. So, right now, I actually think Florida has the most ideal situation out of everyone. But unfortunately, they're governed by the Department of Real Estate. So it's a weird dichotomy because there's at least some structure and some organization there and some governance, right? I think that's the big thing that a lot of these states are missing are governance, right? So there's no one to call and complain about in most states, right? Which is it's a unique thing. But I just, in my humble opinion, which is, worth nothing to most people, I don't think it deserves to be shoved under real estate. In most states that have done some sort of licensing requirement, it's maybe a couple hour add-on to your residential sales license. nothing that we do comes even remotely close to selling residential real estate. And so I just don't understand how lumping it under that makes sense. For me, it has more to do with finance and, you know, being a registered investment advisor. Now, yeah. I also don't think that that is the ultimate goal, right? I don't think that you need your Series 7 license to do a Main Street business deal, right? But there are some states like Texas who have experimented with a broker light or a broker exemption. And so I'm more of a fan of the Securities and Exchange Commission governing us down, right? That is more in line with what we do. The Business Broker Simplification Act came out and says, you know, business brokers can do stock transactions up to $300 million and or $30 million in EBITDA. To me, that's a crazy large number, and you should probably have your investment banking in Series 7, 11, or whatever you want to do a transaction of that size. I don't know where the exact number is, but so, you know, in an ideal world, if I could wave my magic wand, it would be under the Securities and Exchange Commission's in some sort of broker light dealing, but that also just doesn't exist today. So,
yeah. And it's interesting too, when you say like it could fall under that because of the what you're doing and what you're dealing with. And then I think of the accounting side. So I think of the financials, the P&Ls and the balance, like all the stuff that you're looking at in order to get something ready to sell or to present it, you know, and what a buyer's going to look at. And then I think of, you know, the finance background, accounting, and it's some weird blend of all of those things to be successful.
You if you're going to be successful in this industry, you definitely have to know how to read P&Ls, balance sheets, tax returns, all of that. That's why most brokers in this industry are ex-CPAs, financial, you know, some sort of accounting style background. Makes it really easy to transition because that is a lot of what we do.
So one of the things that I know happens is that people don't know business brokers exist. So they end up doing it themselves if they realize they have something they could sell or they think they should try to sell it. I also hear a lot of stories from people like yourself where business owners just don't know it is the thing or never built it to sell, and they just close their doors and retire and they just walk away. And then there's the, we'll call it the FISBO, right? The for sale by owner crowd. Where do you see that? Do you come across those? What challenges that have? What would you want to shake somebody who's thinking about doing that, you know, if they did get aware of someone like yourself?
So for me, the biggest thing for any business is valuation. And and I think what a lot of people don't understand is business valuation is a broad term. And the reason why you're getting a business valuation can actually dramatically swing the number that it hits, right? And so the value of your business when it comes to a sale or an exit is unique. It's not the same valuation that you're going to do if you're getting an SBA loan or a bank loan, or it's not the same valuation for IRS or anything like that, right? So I would say valuation is the biggest thing that those owners should be considering. And I believe the IBBA just recently put out some stats that said roughly a 30% increase in value by using a business broker and not. That is not a small number. That is a drastic number. And I tell people it's why private equity people and family office people and individual buyers, we have a love-hate relationship with business brokers. The cold, hard reality is we drive up price. We create market competition and we drive up price. And so I think that's why you meet most business buyers go, I have so much success going off market. And they do, because they go direct to the seller who has no idea what their business is actually worth. And they're generally able, from a buy side, able to negotiate a much stronger position from themselves, where if a broker or someone like us got involved, we're able to kind of drive that strategic price.
It makes total sense, right? Because if we think about, while we know it doesn't fall under real estate and it's not like real estate, but most people can imagine a real estate example. I remember years and years ago was working with residential real estate and distressed properties. And it was like, if you could get a hold of someone where their house is not in good shape, you could probably get a good deal for it versus if they put it on the market, now there's public competition, right? Like now it's out there and then who knows what's going to happen with it. And so that makes sense, right? Is that if it's with a broker, it's going to do that. But yeah, again, you're at odds with the PE and the buyers who bought a course from a guru and just want to go and get a good deal for no money down, right?
Yeah, which is its whole unique new thing that's happening. I tell people I have a love-hate relationship with these gurus. They're out there selling courses because at the end of the day, in my opinion, most of these so-called gurus are not actually offering great advice and not helping these buyers out. Most, not all, there are some good ones. It's created, you kind of hit the market demand. The market demand is, at least in Texas and Southeast right now, which is primarily our market, is insane. There are more buyers on market than we know what to do with. And it doesn't matter what quality of business we take to market. And we're generating 50 inquiries on a bad day for a bad business, which is just a crazy thing. Didn't happen, less than 5-6 years ago. These gurus have made buying business cool, right? You go on social media, it's the thing to buy a business. And so they have their part to play in driving up demand, which is pretty funny because their whole thing is they can teach these people to get a better deal. And the more that they promote themselves, the more the demand goes up and the more we're able to negotiate that way. So,
yeah, the more people who see dollar signs in laundromats only drives up the price of laundromats for everybody. And it's no longer the easy, passive income, air quotes, because it's never passive, but like it's just not a thing. So it is funny to see that trend. Like if you're not early on in something, like is no longer the thing.
But you know what's funny too? So even if you look at laundromats, dry cleaning, car washes, things like that, social media has actually drastically changed those industries. And I think in a way that most people don't even know. So when I got into the industry, they would say, hey, go find a coin operated car wash or a laundromat. They're the easiest things to sell and to make your first buck because 90%+ of them were actually money laundering. They were all cash operated. And I remember listing one and we had a buyer who actually had financial or a seller who had financials and the buyer's like, I don't want that. They've been reporting to the IRS what they make. So it's been interesting because they were able to move in on this industry. Now the entire industry is reporting income. It's no longer money laundering. It's no longer, it used to be a dirty word in our industry of like, oh, if you did those, you were dealing with some shady people. And now it's mainstream. Everybody wants one and you can't even find one. So it's been interesting to watch a whole sub industry completely change in who owns, operates and buys them. So
that's wild. So if we think about your 10 years and then also this ties into the buyers and the PE firms and the gurus and all of that stuff and the market demands, like you said, where there's more demand than there is inventory. It's totally out of balance in favor of sellers. Like if a seller goes to market, like it's going to be a good thing for them if they have representation, if they have a good valuation, if they have a good business to sell, like good enough that they can represent it. Where are you seeing the challenges or where does it come into play where maybe you're dealing with a business owner who wants to sell or you're trying to get in touch with someone who wants to sell, yet they're getting hammered by phone calls, emails, and text from everyone else who just wants to go direct to buy from them? Like, is it hard to reach business owners anymore? Are they shut down and guarded because, everyone's hitting them from all angles?
Yeah, they are. And I think it's, our industry's been interesting in that fact that they've always been shut down and guarded, right? So if you look at who the actual business owners are, it's someone who's been running a business for 30+ years. And they're experts in their industry. And they've actually been getting hit up for the last decade plus on sell your business, right? And so this is nothing new to them. Now, the volume is probably new. It's always hard to get in front of sellers. And it's, you hear the terms, the baby boomer exodus and the silver tsunami and all of that stuff. The reality is that's also happening at the same time. Just most of those business owners are going unrepresented. They're going off market. So these off market, they are winning some of these transactions, right? And so it is a it is a little bit of a public service announcement to these business owners. Go find quality representation in your exit, because the money's there. You can get the money. The IBBA is doing great things with the mass promotion of Sell Your Way and trying to educate business owners and doing things like that. But yeah, most of these business owners are there and they just don't know. And so it is the kind of the goldmine of how do you get to an exiting business owner when they're going to exit. And, I've yet to meet someone who's got that golden checkbox or golden key to get that.
Yeah, that's always the thing. And I'm sure if anyone did discover that, they wouldn't share it, because it's just printing money at that point, if they can figure that out. And it's tough too, because if I think also of that business owner, they've always been guarded. They may be getting solicitations. They're also, like you said, busy running their business. Their heads down. They're not thinking about it. And from what I've seen, and then what I've heard so many stories from brokers on, is that, business owners aren't building to sell. They're not thinking about selling until it's time to sell. And usually at that point, there's work that needs to be done, but they're just not doing it. Are you seeing that still as the case? Like, is that just going to be like a perpetual cycle of people who come to you? Let's say that owner who says, I'm interviewing three brokers, I'd like to hear what you say. But they've got something that financials are a mess, owner dependency, client concentration, those kind of things.
So, yeah, I mean, it's both right now, which I think is also interesting and a great thing for our industry. So I would say the majority of business owners today were not building with the exit in mind, mm-hmm. right? And most of the calls that we receive are, holy cow, I'm somewhere between 50 and 70 and I'm done doing this. My wife has told me to do it. My spouse, my children want me to retire, all of that. And I have no idea how. That is the majority of people that we speak with. And I kind of laugh too at people who are hard on these businesses. And again, I think it comes from the gurus of it has to be perfect and clean. There is no mm-hmm. perfect business. The only perfect and clean businesses are the publicly traded ones, because they're held to such high standards, right? And that's, less than 1,000 companies, or, the Fortune 100, 500,000. You're not buying that. Mom and pop Main Street businesses are not perfect and clean. They've all got issues. They've all got some issue. My one big piece of advice for buyers is find the issue that you can fix. If you can fix the issue, that's the business you buy today, and that's what you make better. But to go back to your question, I actually think that we're seeing a shift in people, and I think we're very early on, but we're seeing a shift in owners who are building businesses to sell and to exit. I don't know when that wave hits, but I see that wave coming. There are so many buyers out there who are grabbing these 30-year-old businesses that are really only doing $1 to $3 million a year, and they're buying them with the intent to build them up, to make them better to sell. And then if you just look at the, I sound old saying this, but the kids coming out of college these days, right? ETA is its own movement, and it's an actual class in college. Entrepreneurship through acquisition, right? Is it what these kids are being taught? They're not being taught go work for a firm. They're not being taught go build something. They're being taught go buy something and make it better. So you have a whole wave that is, 20 years out still, that is absolutely has the intent of a future exit. And so those business owners are going to be here. So there is some longevity for our industry in that movement.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought exercise and or crystal ball kind of forecasting to think about this. The wave of the founder-led business, right? Somebody started this business 20, 30 years ago. They've built it, they've put it on their back. They've gone from the kitchen table or the garage to whatever they've got as a 20, 30, 100 person, company. And they've just figured it out along the way, and they've made all the mistakes, and they've just made it work and just done that without necessarily the goal of selling. They've just done it because they needed to do it. And then you've got the wave of the buyers who are buying this, like you said, to then just maybe fix it up, or because maybe they're a corporate refugee or something happened, or maybe it's this the wave of the students coming out with the ETA education and dreams, and then they're buying something. And then when they go to sell, what does that wave look like? I also wonder too about the success of, you go to school, you take a course, you go look for a business, you buy a business. That is in no way going to fully prepare you for what it's like to run a business with employees, because there's a lot that you learn along the way of, you know, the painful bits that give you the scars. And so I'm just curious, like, you have any thoughts on that, or have you had discussions around what that, the success of that's going to look like, or is there going to be like a bubble and a wave of business foreclosures, you know, like real estate?
So I don't see that bubble and wave of foreclosures hitting. And here's why. I think a lot of the banks learned their lessons from the real estate stuff. So, you know, to do a little peel back the covers, if you will, coming out of COVID, the regulations were off, the multiples were low, the interest rates were low. And if it breathed, the banks would finance it, right? If you could fog a mirror, you could get an SBA loan there for a while. The banks saw the writing on the wall. So it was little things like, if you just take these service-based industries for a while, so HVAC, I don't have an HVAC license, right? But at coming out of COVID, I could go buy an HVAC business without an HVAC license and just say, I'll figure it out. And SBA was financing those. They clamped down on those pretty tight. If you go back into 25, 24, they stopped doing that, right? They clamped down. So I don't see some sort of bubble burst or anything like that, because the banks wised up and they've actually cracked down on the release that they had post-COVID pretty quickly. And I would almost say that we are, it's pretty funny. You meet a new broker in the industry, and they panic every time the SBA shifts. and the old timers are sitting there just going, that's how we've been doing it for years. We just had a fun run after COVID, right? So the banks really tightened up a lot after that. While there are foreclosures happening, right? So there's been shifts into these search funds. And if you've ever had a foreclosure in an SBA loan, SBA just cracked down and they kind of blackballed you. That happened in the last couple months, right? So I think the SBA and these business bankers, they're just a little bit ahead of it in stopping the massive bubble of, as soon as they start to see issues, they're shifting much quicker than the real estate markets did. And you know, the real estate markets did it because they're like, hey, everyone's making money, just keep your mouth shut. These business banks and SBA backed facilitators are much quicker to say, no, go figure out how to do it the right way. So,
which, whenever regulators and lenders do those shifts, it's tough in the moment, like you said, especially for newer brokers to handle that, because they got used to a certain way and or they set their structure up, or, you know, it's easier, it gets harder and harder. You know, same thing happened with mortgage ahead of and then throughout the mortgage kind of meltdown, the real estate meltdown. Things got really hard and difficult, and then it kind of loosened up after that. Let's shift a little bit, because one of the things I mentioned in the intro was that you have a podcast. So the Texas Business Broker podcast. Yeah. Talk a little bit about how that started and why you decided to get into that podcast. If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business.
Yeah. So full disclosure, I'm an ex-marketing guy. I was doing another podcast purely for marketing purposes. And it just kind of wasn't hitting. It was fun, but it wasn't producing anything. And I'm like, all right, if I'm going to stay on this podcast train, I might as well just really hone in and focus on what I know. And that's being a business broker, and it's being a business broker in Texas. And I just kind of reached out to a handful of people and I said, hey, you know, I just want to talk shop. Well, one thing I think people will learn about me is I'm not afraid to talk and I will talk forever. And so what I set out to do is say, because of my position with TAB, I'm on the state board. We were trying to focus on education. It was, hey, let's provide a resource where I bring on other business brokers and we just talk, right? So one of my first episodes was a quote unquote competitor of mine, Dan Altum out of Houston, who we run very similar shops, but he's a Sunbelt guy. I'm an independent, so he's a franchise and independent. We just hopped on and we talked about the differences of running a franchise versus an independent and what that looks like for business brokers and why they might want to choose one or the other. And it was fun. And so it led to that. And then, it, you know, as you hit earlier, it led to me doing an interview with one of the original founders of the Texas Association of Business Brokers, which was an odd. I think it's also kind of sheds a light or highlights how new of an industry we are. Texas, TAB, the Texas Association of Business Brokers, is the oldest association for business brokers in the United States, and it started in 1972. And the founders of TAB went up and other people from other states were coming in and they started the IBBA. And so we are a, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we're a brand new industry. We're a baby industry that's still finding its footing and finding its way. And, you know, for a young buck like me, who's got gray hair, to still be able to go out and interview and just kind of put on record one of the founding members of a state and national association who's won awards, a lifetime achievement awards and stuff like that, and really dive into why'd you even do this? What was a blast and something that I'll cherish no matter who watches the podcast. So
was there any big takeaways from that discussion with him?
For me, one of the biggest takeaways was why they actually started it of, hey, there's a whole bunch of lone wolves. And this is still the thing today. It's a whole bunch of lone wolves. But the reality is we could probably help each other. And if we got together and just put a little bit of parameters around how business should be done and educate newer people coming into the industry, it'll make it easier for us to do deals in the long run. Right. So like that was the reason TAB started. Was to make, hey, if it's going to be easier on myself, I have to educate someone else to do it. And that giving mentality is still in TAB today. You can walk into any TAB launch. So TAB is set up into chapters in all the major metros, and we do a monthly launch. I think you as a new broker can walk into any TAB launch, which is essentially a room full of your competitors, and you can find guidance within that room of how to be a better business broker. And so hearing someone who, you know, 1972 started that out and that was their intent, and me fully remembering walking into a room and being mentored. My mentor was a guy by the name of Mike Miller, who still does deals to this day, works at another business broker, taught me a lot of stuff, super appreciative of Mike. Mike Miller is also one of the founders of it, but you know, so just seeing that pure, hey, let's make the industry better for everyone, still be the kind of core of what TAB and IBBA is today. That's probably one of the biggest takeaways, which is just awesome.
Yeah. And I love that. Like, you know, it's again, it's from my side, it's observation biased. So I talk generally with, speak generally with good brokers who care about the industry and are professionals and do the right thing. For some reason, I don't end up talking to the shady lone wolves or the used car sales people, brokers. But yeah, one of the things I notice and I really appreciate is the abundance mentality. I mean, I think, you know, Andy, I reference this all the time, Andy Cagnetta, he was the second episode that I had, you know, from Transworld. And I was learning the industry still from my side, you know, the marketing, but, you know, the broker just talking to more and more people. And he's like, if all the people who could retire and wanted to put their businesses up for sale did at once, no way could handle it, right? There's not enough brokers. So I think what's interesting is because, like you said, 500 registered brokers in Texas, 150 in Austin, it's just there's competition, but it's also so much supply available. That it's kind of this abundance mentality that I hope continues to persist. It sounds like it's persisted for 55 years or whatever that works out to be, but hopefully it continues.
So far it is, right? I mean, every time you go to a state conference or a national conference, it really is a education moment, a how you doing, how can I help, how's business? And it's still a good camaraderie that we see today.
Yeah, I think that's great. Now, with all of that, I'm curious, because again, you have the podcast, you talk to people, you're on the board, all these things that we've talked about. Do you see a pathway, or would you guess of a time when there is some kind of board certification governing entity for business brokers similar to real estate?
Yeah, 100%. I think it'll happen in my generation, right? So, you know, Texas used to be an anti that. And I just see it with the new people coming up, even some of the older people. Unfortunately, I think it will default to real estate because that's the easiest path forward. California and Florida have already shown the path forward. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, while it's not ideal, it works. Right. So, you know, I think that's how it goes. And then it'll be backed by the IBBA and other associate. Right. So the IBBA actually has a standard and a certification today. It's called a certified business intermediary. You get your CBI, you get some designations. And so, yeah, the groundwork is there for people to do it. Whether or not the IBBA is like the true governing body versus just the association, that's, you know, I think up and could be different. But yeah, as it gets bigger, something will have to happen, because even in Texas, we're getting more and more complaints on bad business brokers.
Really?
You know, I was on a call the other day. We've got a couple of business brokers who have the TAB logo, say they're certified brokers, and they're just not. They're not members. They're not anything. Right. And we're sending them cease and desist letters. And, you know, that's on the rise, right? So the only way to really stop that is to have enforcement. And so it'll change at some point.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because I think IBBA probably isn't going to be the governing body, but it's going to be the association with the lobbyists and the voice of that, right? If you think of realtor is an association. Yeah. It's not the governing body, but they're the union lobbyists, if you will, on behalf of the members. And that would be great. Yes, I agree with you. It shouldn't fall under real estate. There is some aspect of dealing with real estate sometimes in transactions. If you could do real estate, but then have that more than just a couple hours of coursework that goes into it. And it's like a step up. So there's like real estate, there's commercial, and then there's like business brokers. Like, hopefully, I would love to see that. I think it's fascinating how unregulated your specific industry is. And again, what people can do, call themselves, you know, in Texas, somebody could just be a business broker this afternoon, and who knows what's going to happen to those business owners that work with them, right?
No, it is a big thing. And that's, I think that's why I've chosen to get so involved with the Texas Association of Business Brokers and just push education every moment I can. I was at an event yesterday, a network event, and I met a new business broker who's been doing it for a year and a half. And I was like, I don't know who you are. We're still small enough for where I'm like, I at least know names. I might not know everyone personally. And I was like, are you a member of TAB? And he's like, TAB, what's that? And I'm like, let's talk, right? Let's just stop. So it's, you know, thankfully I've been in a place, I've been blessed with the business broker that we have, with the team that we have, that I'm able to spend some time on this. But it definitely is a thing where it's just like, hey, you're operating, you should have some framework, you should have some education, you should do this. So, it's the education's there. It's not only educating business owners that business brokers exist, but it's educating business brokers that they should be continuing to get education and learn themselves.
Yeah. And that's such a wild thing. And I hope for that shift. I know that IBBA, like you mentioned, is working on that too, more of the business facing marketing and content and getting out there to raise that awareness. And, you know, I think that's what it takes. So let's shift to the next portion of the show, which is the broker growth strategies. Now, you've been doing this for 10 years. I know, because you and I have talked about it, and it's a conversation, you know, it's with a lot of brokers, like you just got to make it through that first year, maybe the first 2 years, have the ability to float long enough to close some deals, have some failed things, and then be able to just sustain, right? Like that guy that you met that's a year and a half in, you know, he's still in that kind of that challenge. But you've made it 10 years, you've got your own shop. And so what do you put on that list when you think of growth strategies, things that work, things that really work? Especially what's fascinating and fun about you, Josh, is that from the marketing side, like there's the things that people think they should do, and then there's the things that maybe actually work. So what do you have on the list?
Yeah, no. So I think you hit one of the biggest ones is having that trajectory and that time set aside to dedicate to the craft, right? So a lot of people think this is like real estate and they can just jump in and close a deal and get a check in a couple months. And that's just not the reality. The cold, hard reality is you need a year plus to dedicate yourself to this industry to get started. And I think it's one of the reasons why we don't have 20,000 business brokers in Texas, right? Is the cold hard facts are it's 7 to 9 months to close a transaction today. And that is good timing. That's a quick timeline compared to where we used to be. So 7 months if you're great, but it's also going to take you 3 months to find a deal and to keep going. So you need a minimum financial security blanket, mental security blanket. Comically, we've mentored a lot of business brokers who have come into the industry, and we harp pretty hard on, we actually check finances. If you can't go a year without a check, you can't come work for us, right? Because I'm not going to put a broker or an individual in that situation. And then I tell people, I go, but by the way, there is a mental aspect of working for a year for a hopeful check that not a lot of people can stomach. And I've sat with several brokers who, when I go to hand them their first check, they go, hey, so I was prepared financially, but mentally, yeah, I'm not gonna lie, there was a couple breaking points where so giving yourself the mental clarity and the runway and the support network of a year plus, that's the only way you can get into this industry and truly succeed because of the length of time it takes to close a deal. So that's probably one of the biggest ones.
It's fascinating because, you know, many times I've talked on the show with others about the financial side and the runway. The group that introduced me to business brokerage when I was doing sales consulting. Mm-hmm. So Gregory Kofsky out of Seattle with IBA, his requirement is 2 years. Every new broker that comes work for him, 2 years financial runway. Just don't force anything. Don't get desperate. Just be able to do that. But what rarely comes up, which I appreciate you talking about, is the mental side. It's one thing to financially be okay. It's another one to you and or let's say your spouse or your family being okay with not making any money. I remember when I was in real estate a long time ago and, you know, dealing with distressed houses and people in foreclosure. I remember being self-employed. I remember calling my parents and they asked me how things were going. I was like, it was great. We got a new property that we're working on. And they're like, all right, great. When are you going to make money? Right? Baby boomer parents, paychecks, security, benefits. And I'm like, if everything goes well, I think it's going to be about 3 months and we might get paid. Mm-hmm. And they're supportive, but they were freaking out. They're like, oh, are you serious? Like, yeah, hopefully if it works well, you know, if this works out, it will. So that mental side is definitely a big deal to just keep grinding it out on faith and hope. But also deals fall apart, right?
Yeah. No, it happens. I mean, we've got one transaction right now that, you know, thanks to tariffs and tariff rebates and all this other, we're 2 years in on a transaction, right? Still working it, still going, haven't gotten paid yet, knock on wood, we'll close it, right? So it is a thing. I think that's just the biggest piece of this industry is not a get rich quick industry.
Yeah.
You can have a very successful career. You can be very successful. There are people who make a lot of money in this industry, but every one of them have earned it, right? It's not a get rich quick industry. So just, you have to commit for the long term, right? To truly be successful in this industry, which kind of brings me up to that second point. I think that a lot of people transition, they go, oh, we're just going to do SEO. We're going to do quick marketing and all that. And it helps. It's how you get started in the industry. But if you really want to be successful in this industry, you have to build a strong referral network. The reality is all these business owners that are exiting that we're talking about, they all have advisors on their team. The good businesses, right? They have some sort of advisor on their team already. And business broker, we learned a long time ago, if I want to turn on pay-per-click, I could keep the phones wouldn't stop ringing. Everybody would be busy. Nobody would actually close anything because business brokers are generally the last phone call a business owner makes, right? The phone calls that we got when we were doing pay-per-click and stuff like that were for restaurant owners. And we just start asking them, how long do you have? I'm closing my doors in 3 months. All right. Well, it takes 7 months to close a transaction. So what do we want to do here? Right. So, true success in this industry, you have to plan for long term, and doing so means building a network of other trusted business advisors who are going to hear long before you hear that a business is looking for sale, and hopefully bring you in on that transaction to help educate the owner on the process and what that looks like.
Yeah, it makes sense, right? Because they're already in the business. They're looking at the business. That business owner who has an attorney, has a CPA, wealth advisor is having those conversations and hopefully planting the seeds about that future moment, right? I think of wealth advisors and financial advisors that I know. They're always having that conversation of like, what's your plan? When are you going to retire? What do you need for retirement? And so they're having that conversation, even if the business owners aren't built to sell, at least there's some kind of exit, whether they shut the doors or they sell it. So I think that's great. And you know, obviously that's a long game, right? The tough thing is like referrals are great when they come, they're sporadic and it's like planting an orchard. It's not, you're not planting something where you're eating anytime soon. So what if you like, and I know this is deviating from probably what else is on the list, but you know, what about the short term? Cause it's great. Maybe go to BNI meetings, maybe you're networking with referral partners. Hopefully something comes. What about that short term or more hunting versus farming, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, look, there's the traditional stuff, direct mail, hits and misses, email marketing is the big thing right now. A lot of people laugh, we're sending thousands of emails a month for business owners, right? So there are things, but even in the short term, I've seen people come into this industry and get transactions referred to them inside of 2-3 months, right? So, our opinion, in the way that we train new advisors that when we come on is, A, you need to be prepared for the long term. So you have to start planting those seeds now. But referrals can also come in the short term, right? So it is a big piece. Marketing, branding yourself, doing those types of things. Education is always big. But, that's the traditional forms of marketing still work. Direct mail still works. Hits and misses, right? Sometimes good, sometimes not. Email marketing, social media marketing is a big thing nowadays if it's done right. And I think social media marketing is something that is very hard to do. So much so that I'm an ex-marketing guy, and I think it took us 5-6 years to figure out how to do social media marketing in this industry. But there's some great examples out there of people who are getting clients off of Twitter, getting clients off of Facebook. That's not us, by the way. I couldn't pull a client off of Facebook or Twitter to save my life, but I know for a fact that there are brokers that are doing it, and they're doing it well. There are the traditional channels, but you really have to kind of dive in and be experts in those as well.
You do. I appreciate all that. That's great. Cause I was curious, you know, like other than the referrals, which is great, but like, you know, what works, what else on your list? I'm sure as a marketing growth guy.
Yeah. You got some. Well, the last one on my list was actually education, right? So, not to beat a horse or whatever the expression you want to use, man, education is just so massive in this industry. Whether you come from an investment banking financial background and you think you know everything, the continuing education that groups like TAB or whatever state that you're a business broker in, or the IBBA conference. A lot of people think that the IBBA conference is just one big party. which there may be a few people that have go out for a few drinks or libations or whatever you want to call it. But the education in this industry is massive. And one of the things that at least we harp at Lion is becoming an expert is really your long-term key to success. And the market, being able to differentiate yourself in that way of just educating a business owner and knowing what you're talking about from a point of confidence is massive when you're competing against the person who's been doing it for a year and a half and really still doesn't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because when you first start talking about education, I'm like, okay, that's great. But what about from a marketing standpoint? And it's true because yes, from like, once you get that person, that business owner, that seller, you know, that engage in a conversation, you're moving forward, the expertise is going to be there, right? Like you said, mm-hmm. and we talked about earlier, it's the, I'm interviewing three brokers. Let me see what you got. Right. And then mm-hmm. it's going to be who's both the expert and a good fit, right? Personality yeah. wise and professionally. But then that makes a lot of sense from a marketing growth standpoint, if we put it under that category, because now you have more to lean on. Now you have the expertise. Now you have the education. Hopefully you're putting that into content and conversations and outreach in networking and the referral partners, you know, showing them why like other brokers are hitting them up, that CPA. Yes. And maybe it's the new broker's been doing it for 2 months and then you've been doing it for 10 years and you have that same conversation with the CPA. And obviously, who are they going to send those referrals to? Which means if you're new, education, get as up to speed as quick as possible, even if you don't have the transactional expertise. But that is fascinating to think about how that fits in.
Well, also our education, I think, is unique in a way that it's brokers that are doing it, right? Because you go back to, we're still a new industry, right? 50 years yeah. old, which is relatively new. It's brokers who are actually out there transacting. And one of the first classes, the education classes that we make every broker take is surviving and thriving your first year as a business broker. Wow. There's a full class on, hey, here's what this looks like. Here's how to set yourself up for future. Here's how to do specific types of marketing. And one of the biggest things that we found at IBBA is there are a bunch of classes on how to market yourself, how to niche yourself, how to do all of that, right? So when we're talking about education, I'm lumping in core transactional education of, you know, how to do recasting, right? Financial recasting. I actually retake that course about once every 3 years, even though I think I'm pretty good at it, just to make sure. But our education stuff is about, hey, here's what you need to know when specifically talking to HVAC owners. This is one of the things, I think the number one HVAC business broker in our industry is out of Florida, and he's going to do a training class at IBA on how to sell to more HVAC brokers, right? So how to sell more HVAC business owners. So our education is about building your brand and building your company and building your book of business at the same time.
Yeah. And going to that mode, right? So Patrick Lang is who I'm guessing you're talking about. Just had him on the podcast and he's amazing. And this goes back to the abundance mindset, right? Because I've had Jim Parker on the podcast done a lot of work with him. And so it's so cool to see how many people who, let's say Patrick Lang, HVAC, dominating the HVAC market, is going to do a session on helping people get better at dealing with HVAC companies, which potentially is just creating more competition for him because somebody could choose somebody else. And there's just so much abundance in the space, which is just one of the things I love, right? Like I've been around enough other industries where it's like, you don't see that, right? It's kill or be killed in many other sales related industries versus this.
It is unique to our industry, and you know, one of the great things that you know, I'd be going to an IBBA conference is like, you know, homecoming week or something like that. We're all off doing our own things, but it's fairly few in between where you're actually competing against someone. So learning how to brand and market yourself in your unique way is a massive part of being a business broker.
When you said that last part, it's funny because I'm thinking like sports. I'm a big basketball fan. And so I'm thinking of like the NBA All-Star game. So all first half of the season, everyone's competing. They're all out to get each other, and they're there, you know, on the court. And then all of a sudden the All-Star game, they're basically teammates with their regular competition, and they're just having a blast, and they're learning, they're having a good time. They're learning, they're supporting each other. They're throwing passes. They're just celebrating together. And then, you know, the day after, then it's
back to work.
Back to work, back to war. But I love that. So let's transition to the next part, because I think this is fascinating. I always love this part of the conversation for myself. It's kind of self-centered, but I know it's not always a fun topic, which is the deal that got away. So the lessons of the lost deal. You've been doing this for 10 years. Obviously you're part of TAB and the board and IBBA, and you got the podcast. So you like got your experiences, you see others, you see the trials and the tribulations. When you think of the lessons of a lost deal, and you know, I'm curious, because I know we talked about it before, I'm curious what you're going to say now is, you know, what is it that you would throw out there as like an experience that's that cautionary tale of like, try not to do this or be this person?
So I'm not to, you know, be that guy, but I'm going to throw it in a different direction of, I think I actually have the opposite issue of the lost deal, but I think business brokers should know when to walk away from a deal and cut bait. Okay. We have had more than one transaction that we have hounded. I personally have worked transactions for over 2 years of that you could have turned into the lost deal and probably should have. If you go back and you actually do the hours spent on working a deal for over 2 years on a Main Street deal where commission's going to be less than $100,000, I did not make money, quote unquote, on that transaction, right? And so I think one of the things that I'm trying to still learn as a business owner is when to say no and when to let a deal be lost, right? Of I have a problem of there are no lost deals right outline. There is no lost cause. We're not losing anything. If we started with someone, we're working with them until we find some sort of resolution. And I, you know, financially or from a structural standpoint, I actually think it's to a fault. And it's something that we're trying to work on in turn. At least my senior management team is trying to make better, help me make better decisions of letting stuff go. So it's a really weird thing, but I don't let go of deals. And so I don't have the one that's gotten away because we just keep working for better or worse. And so the takeaway that I'd actually leave with business brokers and what we try to educate some of our new brokers now is you do need to know when to cut bait and just say, hey, this isn't working. This isn't the deal for me. And I actually think it's one of the best and worst mistakes that every new business broker takes on. They take on a deal they should not have taken on. And it's funny, no matter how much we warn new brokers coming in, you're going to hate this deal in 6 months. And one of the things that work in line, I go, you're going to hate this deal in 6 months and you're not allowed to fire that client. Like you're going to see this through and it's going to be a nightmare. And every broker does it. So for everyone that we've met and trained, they all take on that one deal that they should have said that they lost and just ran with.
Yeah, I love that. So I'm curious for you personally as a personality and kind of behavior type, is it a competitive don't want to lose? Is it a empathy don't want to let them down? Is it a anything is possible? Impossible is you know, they say impossible is like impossible is nothing, like it's not impossible. Or is it just the loyalty to a fault, or is it some weird blend of all four of those?
So comically, I think it leads into one of the things that I tell everyone in this industry. There is no black and white in this industry. Everything is gray. There is no absolute answer if you're going to be in this industry. And so for me, it rolls with who I am. It's a blend of one, I am a little competitive and I don't like losing. And so we're not going to lose. We're just going to keep going. And then I'll be honest, I feel for some of these owners, I do have empathy. And, you know, no matter whether a business owner is exiting for $600,000 or $6 million, that's a lot of money to them. Mm-hmm. And whether it be 600 or 6 million, that is life-changing money to them. And they have put their trust in us to retire, to make the next steps, to get out from under their business. And so it is a, I don't like losing, but then once we get someone on, one of the things I actually tell seller clients is, hey, look, you just spent an hour with me. Make sure you like me before you choose me. I'm going to be all in your business for the next year. You have to, we have to get along. Otherwise it just doesn't work. So, I also get then emotionally invested in our clients and want to see them succeed and help them and make sure the transactions go through. So, it's that gray answer of a little bit of everything.
Yeah. I could totally see that, especially with you and the little that I know and how I've gotten to know you, since we first chatted and what I could see as that dynamic. And it's just like, it should be possible. There's gotta be a way, right? I learned that years ago when I worked for a business owner and I was like, it didn't work. Like, let's just move on. And he taught me some real world lessons of like, you'll know when it's over when you can say you did everything possible. And I have some stories from my side and some sales experiences where it's like, I can honestly say that deal didn't go through. And I literally did everything I could, right? Like, and until you can say that, it's tough to just want to stop because it's like, what else? There could be something else. Like, how do you do it? And it's funny, earlier when I was thinking about your deal that took 2 years and, you know, those kind of long deals, I'm imagining like the whiteboard you might have in the office if you have it written up there. And I'm like, I'm thinking that deal's done and you go to erase it and it's just been up there so long. It's just like permanent. It's just like this shadow in there. And like, you just see it forever because it's now a permanent part of the whiteboard. It's like you can't clean it up.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can even see it from here still. So,
and it's still haunting you and reminding you. It's like, okay, just buy a new whiteboard. Like just buy a new whiteboard. Let's just move on from that. So yeah, I think that's a good one. I appreciate that stance because I think it is important to know those ones because, you know, it's kind of like therapy as well. You know, you can't do everything for that business owner or for that buyer. So it's not even yours to control. Everyone's got to do their part. And if it's just not working or someone's not doing their part, there's got to be like any relationship. There's just a point where it's like, this just isn't working.
That is the biggest problem. You know, I think I have a lot easier time doing that with buyers and cutting buyers loose just because there are so many. And I've been doing this. I'm a little jaded when it comes to some of the buyers that are on market now. So I'm a little quicker to cut buyers loose and just be like, nah, we're wasting our time, move on. But not with sellers. I treasure our sellers.
Yeah, I love it. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to stop. I appreciate you sharing that and then the marketing tips and everything we talked about, especially with TAB and education and industry. For people who want to reach out to you, find out more about what you're doing, I know they can go to lionbusinessbrokers.com. Your email will be in the show notes as well. You're all over LinkedIn. You've got YouTube channel. You got the things, obviously not Twitter. And what was the other one I said? Not Facebook.
We're on there. We're just, you know.
You're not doing it for lead generation purposes. I don't know. Are you on TikTok?
We are on TikTok. I do laugh. So I have teenage sons and their parlor trick with their friends is that I'm a TikTok and YouTube superstar. I'm not, by the way. I'm so far from it. It's anyone who knows business, I am a peon with, you know, but I have a couple of videos that have gotten like 20,000-30,000 views. And so my teenage sons love it. They go, Google my dad, watch this. And I've at least done good enough. I'm like, it's just SEO. I've managed to, if you're going to search me, you can find me. Josh Carnes, Google me, find me. I'm out there.
Yeah. And it's funny because I have a funny story about that. When I had my original podcast, I think it was my third or fourth guest on the show. I asked him, I said, hey, Rob, how can people find you? This is before I like shared where people could find you. And he's like, Google me. I'm the number one Rob Howes on Google. Just Google me. And I was like, at the time, this is 2019. I was like, this is amazing. And so after we recorded, I went on, I was chatting with him and I was like, let me search myself. And I was like the fifth Jason Cutter of all Jason Cutters. And I was like, that's not happening. And so I spent many years doing lots of content and making sure that's not a thing. So I love that you're number one. Ranked Josh Carnes.
Number one. And others that start to creep in every once in a while. I'm like, I got to do some more content.
I've made it so that any of the other Jasons, if they get to page one, they're lucky. Usually they're around page five. So nobody cares about airplane Jason Cutter or Professor Jason Cutter. Like, it's just not a thing. Sorry, other Jason Cutters out there. So thank you for being here, Josh. I appreciate it. This has been a blast. I can't wait till the after show. I knew we were going to have a lot of fun. I always love talking to somebody who has a podcast. They get some free reign to just be a guest and let it all fly, and they don't have to worry about, you know, holding back on it. So I appreciate all that you've shared here on the show and given to the audience today.
No, thank you so much for having me on. I second it. It's been a blast. I love chatting. I'll talk forever. It's probably why I started a podcast. So totally appreciate you having me on.
It's the best thing to do. If you like talking, you know, and you like talking to people, then definitely start a podcast. It's something I recommend, because then it's okay for you to do that. For everyone tuning in, appreciate you being here. Thanks for being a part of this. Hopefully you learned some things, whether you're a broker, you're a business owner, or you're a buyer, wherever you're at in the process of transactions, maybe a referral partner, and you want to learn more about the industry, you wanted to learn more about Josh, here you go. Lots of content. Please make sure to come back for the after show. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show, hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.